Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. In this episode, we take the LN2 bottle on the road for an overclocking adventure at the Boise Land. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia. With me today, I have Darren McCain.
Dennis, in the last episode, we talked quite a bit about our preparations for the Boise LAN party.
Mm-hmm. Building some systems.
And we do talk quite a bit about that because, as you know, I'm a huge LAN party fan. But this last time around, we did something a little special, a little exciting. We teased about it in the past, but we finally got around to the granddaddy of them all, LN2 overclocking.
Yes, the pinnacle overclocking. You can control temperatures, it is what sets records, and I say it's probably the funnest bit of overclocking you can watch because the person doing the overclocking is actively maintaining the system. It's not like having an air cooler or a water cooler running in the background while you are clocking your system, or a phase that sits there in the corner. You actually have to pour the LN2 to cool down the system.
I have to agree. Not only is it very cool to watch, just the activity alone, but there's a mystique to it almost because you got the crazy freezing stuff, you got the torch going, you got steam or whatever you want to say, just everywhere. There's like a fog of overclocking madness. I think that it's probably the most watchable overclocking there is. And so I'm excited that we got it out at the LAN party. But I know there were reasons why it took some time. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about what it takes to do LN2 overclocking, particularly on the go.
On the go, it takes a whole lot of stuff. Like literally, you have to have 2 to 3 boxes worth of stuff to carry with you. And I'm surprised that the people that do competition overclocking, they can get everything to fit in a suitcase that goes on an airplane. I had a box that had my bench table and power supply and video cards. And then we had the LN2 supplies, which would be like paper towels and the container. And all that stuff was just, I don't know, it was a lot of stuff.
Well, it sounds like a lot of stuff. And with that in mind, then why would we want to do LN2? Obviously, it's a show.
It is a show. And I want to say that it's driven by past experiences at the Boise LAN. So a couple of LANs ago, we were overclocking with dry ice. And that was the first time I had ever done dry ice overclocking. And I want to say it was really fun, but it wasn't as spectacular as LN2. But it got a crowd. So a lot of people came over to ask about it. We had people videoing inside there when the dry ice was bubbling the rubbing alcohol.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But it was just kind of boiling away and kind of, it looked like syrup. It was pretty awesome.
Well, we're pretty fond of the money shots, maybe is the right term, where you can get those awesome pictures of the frost buildup on the copper pots.
Oh, yeah, the frost shots, as I call them.
Frost shot, there you go. That's an even better term. Because I think that in most people's minds, that is the cutting edge, if you will. That's the mission to Mars for overclocking.
Well, and a lot of people don't understand that. So that LAN party was pretty successful in terms of overclocking. The next one that we went to, I wanted it to be a bit more extreme. So I brought in the phase. I brought in a system that was running 3-way SLI. And the CPU was basically, it was on water, but I also had it hooked up to the phase, and we brought down the power like 3 times.
Yeah, we did.
But part of that was, you know, I had 3 massively overclocked video cards plus the CPU and the phase, which is, you know, it's an industrial cooler for the most part. So there was a huge power draw. So that was not necessarily LAN friendly.
Well, we got people's attention though.
Oh yeah, we did. And yeah, we got accused of overclocking too hard a couple of times.
Overclocking too hard.
And the way that I look at it is from results. So when I was overclocking with dry ice, I was running just basic CPU benchmarks, and I was getting some scores that I could submit to HardwareBot. With the 3-way SLI, the competition on HardwareBot's a little bit different for that. I was basically limited by the subsystem that I was overclocking with, to the point where the video cards were doing well, but the CPU couldn't deliver enough data. So while it was fun to watch and a lot of people were really interested in it, I didn't get a lot out of it. So next step.
Next step it is. But before we get too deep into the system, you talked about the big box of stuff, if you will, that is required to do this, which is part of the barrier of entry. But I want to talk about the amount of work it takes to set up a system and get it ready to do overclocking with LN2, because it's really a different animal than all those different things that you've talked about. Well, maybe dry ice is kind of in the same zone. this is, I think, one of the reasons that more people don't do LN2 overclocking. Well, one of the major ones is because, I mean, it really isn't easy because of that system prep. So let's talk through that.
So for system prep, the one thing that you need to do, this is bare minimum. You have to separate your electronics from water. And it sounds kind of, well, yeah, you don't want to pour water on your motherboard, but there's condensation in the air. There's water in the air. We exhale water when we breathe. You know, it just kind of naturally evaporates. People are moving around. It's in the air. Well, what happens when you take like a cold soda out of the fridge and put it on the table in the summertime?
Oh, man, you get a ring.
You get a ring. It starts to sweat. That's the water that we need to keep off of the electronics. Well, when you start cooling down your system to negative 160 degrees centigrade, it creates a lot of ice. Well, the heating and cooling cycle of that is going to create ice and water everywhere. So you need to create what they call insulation layer or an insulation. I like to use kneaded eraser. So you kind of work it until it gets warm and then you push it into the little crevices around the CPU and around the socket, around the memory slots. And that creates that barrier.
Now I've heard some stories about exotic overclocking setups that are like dipped in mineral oil and stuff. Is there an advantage of using something like that over kneaded eraser? Are we gaining anything by insulating the system versus isolating it in a different way?
Selfishness. I like to keep my hardware clean. For instance, you know, Vince Kingpin, he bathes his hardware, video cards and motherboards in Vaseline for the most part. It's a petroleum jelly. And when you paint that on there, it becomes permanent. It becomes a part of the board and you can never use it for anything else except for overclocking.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I see. Now, some people might have the budget for that.
But also, he's been overclocking in Taiwan, which the humidity there is crazy. And if it just gets down to like negative 30, you can have water all over the board. It might be frost around the container. There's a cold zone that kind of radiates in a circle. And when it gets between the part where it's frozen and the part where it's not frozen, it creates water. And that is not necessarily around the CPU. That's might be where the video card is. Some of the exotic cooling solutions like mineral oil, like what you mentioned, it takes place of that Vaseline. So you dip the entire board into this non-conductive liquid and it separates the air from the electronics via the, you know, mineral oil, whatever it happens to be. So you don't have to do that crazy system prep, but it ruins the electronics similar to putting Vaseline on your motherboard to the point where it's really hard to get off there. And then you have to make sure that it stays clean because the dust from the air will get in there and that creates electrical contacts.
So basically these exotic methods may work once or twice, but then you've pretty much shot your wad.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the barriers of entry. Now you've talked about some exotic materials, but I know that one of the reasons that we don't do LN2 more often is because you can't just go down to the local convenience store and buy some LN2.
No, you can buy dry ice at the local grocery store, but liquid nitrogen is an industrial gas for the most part. It just happens to be the cold version of it. So I go to one of the local suppliers that is a welding supply store, but they also supply hospitals and other people that need nitrogen gases or any sort of gas. The problem is cost. And much like going to the grocery store, you can buy things in bulk much cheaper. For the average user, you'd only need like maybe 25 to 30 liters and you can get a good 4-hour overclocking session in, but that might cost you $80 to $90. Whereas you can buy a 180, 200 liter tank and it will be $200. So all of a sudden, instead of being $4 a liter, it goes down to $1 a liter just because it's in bulk.
Now you are talking about $180, or I'm sorry, $200 for 180 liters. Let me get it straight. I think that you're only talking about the LN2. You're not talking about the cost of containing it, right?
Right. Because when you get a 180 liter tank, which is, you know, 5 feet tall, that's what, $2 a day to rent it. And then it has to be delivered. And then you have to have a way to withdraw the liquid from the tank. And that's a $200 hose. Then that is just to get the liquid nitrogen to where you can use it. After that, you need to have your copper container that goes on top of the CPU, and that is a specially designed piece. And then all of the consumables, which would be like paper towels, the kneaded eraser, the bench table. In my case, I built a bench table that had insulation on the back so that none of the air could get in there. Otherwise, I would have to actually treat the back of the board with kneaded eraser or grease or whatever.
So maybe a little bit interesting to me is that there's kind of a cascading process where you go from the large tank down to the pour. And maybe just talk us through that real quick, because I find that interesting and it's kind of part of the show, right?
Yeah, it is. So you have the big tank and then you have the withdrawal device or the hose that is connected to it. Turn on a valve and then you hear this big loud whistling because you just get pure gas coming out of there until it cools down. And then the liquid nitrogen starts to flow out and it sounds like a really loud hose, I guess.
Right.
Fills up your other Dewar. So I pour from the 180 liter into a 25 liter. And incidentally, that's the one I took to the LAN party. And then it goes from the 25 liter Dewar into some flasks, like, you know, the vacuum bottles that you can buy at Walmart.
Right, right.
I have a couple of Stanley ones, one with a handle that's 2.5 liters, and then a couple of hand ones that are just a liter. And then I pour those, and that's what I use when I'm running through my benchmark. Depending on the benchmark and what hardware I'm running, I will go through all 4.5 liters for one benchmark. And then afterwards, I have to go and fill it back up and start all over.
Well, it sounds like a good opportunity to talk a little bit more about the hardware that we used for this demo. You know, you mentioned that you have to have a custom pot, so maybe that's a good place to start. I know we've talked in the past about a couple of different pots that you use, some for video cards and some for the processors, but what did we use for this demo?
Oh, well, I only have one CPU container. I wish I had more, but I only have one, and it's awesome. It was made by DeBauer, and it's called the Beast.
The Beast, I love it.
And it's a huge copper slug that was basically hogged out in the middle and has a bunch of plunge holes. Basically, you take a drill and you go all the way down, but it was a machine, so it's all flat and everything. And it's got some, it's hard to describe. I will put a picture of it in the show notes because it is just amazing to look at. And everyone jokes about German engineering, but DeBauer's from Germany. And I'm talking about tolerances where the copper slug is so cold that sometimes the aluminum extension will not fit in there unless you have it the same temperature. And that is just amazing to me.
That's kind of interesting. All right. Well, let's talk about the test system itself. Now, you had several options here, and I think that your choice for this particular LAN party was interesting. In fact, your builds are always interesting because there seems to be sometimes some unusual rhyme or reason behind your hardware choices because you have so many options.
So in this one, I was using the Asus Rampage 6 Apex, which was a brand new board that I had just gotten in. It's designed for high-end overclocking. It's also kind of a retail board. It's got LEDs everywhere. This is a board that had special instructions on how to overclock certain processors to get voltage into the right areas. It was pretty well detailed. As far as I can tell, the only board on the market that had that sort of ability.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, there have been quite a few cup runs and records established with the Apex board, too. It's a pretty popular board.
It was one of the first ones to hit 7 gigahertz on a Core i7-7740X.
Speaking of such things, that sounds like the same processor that we used.
It was, and it was one that I deleted using a deleting tool that we talked about in an earlier podcast.
Very nice.
Try to link that in the show notes, but with that combination, I was able to get a comfortable 6 gigahertz on LN2. I will freely admit that the processor was junk.
Oh, now that's no good.
It's no good.
I want to pursue that, but you haven't given me the rest of the build, and I know I always want to know the rest of the build. So we'll come back to that processor.
Okay, so the rest of the build. Basically, it was the CPU container, the Beast, like I was talking about. We were using some G-Skill Trident RGB, some 4133 megahertz stuff.
Very nice.
Unfortunately, I was not able to run 4133 because the processor was junk.
No. Oh.
But I matched that with a EVGA 780 Ti Kingpin Edition card.
Nice.
And the reason I don't know, I love that card. It was the one that got away.
Yeah, that's right.
That was the white whale. I found one in Sun Valley. If anyone knows anything about Idaho, it's right next to where we live. And I found it on eBay, and I was really surprised because it was one of those that the guy had the card, and then he had problems with it. He sent it back to EVGA, got the replacement card, and he never opened it.
Wow, now that's an impressive white whale achievement there.
Yeah. I was able to take that card, and I was overclocking that one at 6 gigahertz. Well, CPU at 6 gigahertz. Video card just mildly overclocked, but it came that way from the factory too.
Very nice. All right, well, let's come back to that processor because I know a lot of folks out there would be super happy to have an i7-7740X because it is such an overclock-friendly processor, but you said no good.
It was mostly the memory controller. It would not run 4133 megahertz like it's supposed to. The core itself is based off of the 7700K Kaby Lake. And this was the cut-down version that would fit into the LGA 2066 socket. But it only used two memory channels, unlike the four that the motherboards normally support. In terms of overclocking, it does well because it doesn't have a lot of cores to deal with. So you can run really high CPU frequencies. It supports faster memory. And it's pretty power efficient. So we put it on an Apex board. It has plenty of power to run. So it's not going to be stressing the board at all. In terms of overclockability, it's cheap. So if you burn it up, you get a new one.
Perfect. Well, I want to talk about the overclocking results, but before we do that, let's talk a little bit more about the LAN party, because setting up in the lab here at the Hardware Asylum complex, if you will, is, I know, very different than taking your show on the road, as we've talked about before. I know that adds an extra layer of complication, if you will, to the overclocking run. And you sort of alluded to that already, but I want to talk a little bit more about the differences in overclocking as a demo or in front of a crowd versus, you know, overclocking in a controlled environment, and how that affected this particular run.
Okay, well, Darren is familiar with paintballing.
Yes.
And when you go to a competition, you usually have your duffel bag of stuff.
Of course.
And what happens when you get to the field and you forget, say, an air tank?
Yeah, that's no good. Well, hopefully you have a backup, or someone else does, or you scramble to buy, rent, steal, whatever you can, so that you can compete.
Yes. Well, the difference is you're going to a competition where that is actually available. In my case, I was going to a LAN party, and I was trying to remember everything I needed to bring. So, you know, you have a box of the hardware, the basic system. So you have the motherboard, the bench table, the video card, SSD. Almost forgot that.
Right.
Actually, I did forget that. I brought the wrong one. So that, see, key. And power supply, container, insulation, paper towels, voltmeter, temperature gauge. You see where I'm going?
Yeah, it's a pretty lengthy list, actually. You know, I've seen a lot of LAN party checklists. Ironically, after so many years of doing LAN parties, I still work myself down one of those lists every time I pack. But now that you mention it, I don't know that there is such a thing as an overclocking on the go checklist. Maybe we should make one.
We should probably make one, yes.
Probably.
Basically, I kind of illustrated all the stuff that needed to go into these two boxes of stuff, and, you know, then load them into the car so I could take them down there. I'd already mentioned that I brought the wrong SSD. I almost forgot, drumroll, thermal paste.
Seems important.
Seems very important. I got all the way out of my subdivision and remembered, oh, thermal paste. Turn around, go back, grab the thermal paste, get back on the road and take off.
Almost had to use the nacho cheese.
Almost. Probably should have, actually. Might have worked better.
There you go.
But yeah, then when you get to the event, then it's a matter of, okay, find power, find a network connection, set up a table. Constantine at the Boise LAN was amazing. He had a whole area set aside for us. You know, it's actually right next to where we were gaming, so people could come by. It's fairly well open, and we brought over a television this time so we could do a dual screen, which was pretty awesome.
Very nice. Very nice.
But basically, it takes about a half hour to set up completely from scratch, basically taking the system apart. So put the motherboard down, lock it in place, attach the container. After you do the insulation bits, wrap some paper towels around it, catch a little bit of extra water. Believe it or not, when you have 3/4 of an inch of insulation going around a copper slug at a -130°C, that insulation still gets frosty. But put all that together and then fire up the system and hope it works.
Didn't blow the power this time around.
Didn't blow the power. That was our big win.
We have also seen you do overclocking competitions in the past, and you've done overclocking in some pretty large venues. How does that differ?
Well, in the larger venues that I've overclocked when, they were still virtual. So I was overclocking at the house, and I could kind of go out whenever I had time. At an event like the Boise LAN, I had basically an hour and a half that I allotted to do my overclocking demonstration. So that half hour of scrambling to get set up, and then the time clicks in, and then somehow people magically show up, even though I'm not necessarily ready, which is kind of fun. But yeah, get the system fired up and then run through a couple of benchmarks and then explain what it is that you're doing while you're trying to overclock. And we had the benefit this time of an HDMI splitter that was doubling my screen onto a big television so people could see the benchmark as it was running, which was kind of fun.
I do think that's really successful, especially when you have folks that haven't seen some of these 3D Mark test demos run, or the benchmarks rather, because they have kind of some cool stuff going on the screen.
I can also at that point explain how I checkmark certain benchmarks. So in 3D Mark 06, for instance, I look at two things. So there's the point where the door comes down when they're exiting the spacecraft. You can get an idea of how well the benchmark's going to run by what frame rate you're hitting, and if it's going to be better or worse than the previous run. And then there's another one where the monster jumps out of the water to get the balloon toward the end.
Right.
So if it hits a certain frame rate, you know that it's faster than the previous run. So that's how you can kind of gauge how those benchmarks run. And we had somebody come up and say, hey, I ran this benchmark on my system.
Oh, I remember. Yeah. Now, this is kind of interesting because we've talked in the past about how can we get the folks at the LAN party more involved, because, you know, they're not there necessarily to see the overclocking competition. They're there for the LAN party. They're for the competitions. And we're kind of the sideshow, if you will. When we had this particular fellow, we had a handful of folks come up, but this particular fellow tells us that he'd run the benchmarks. His throw out there was what?
Oh, so he ran Firestrike, the regular vanilla Firestrike.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a picture of the screen saying this was his score. 12,001, I think is what it was. And I'm looking at that, I'm like, I can beat that. I didn't know anything about his system. I didn't know what kind of video card he had. I didn't know what kind of CPU he had. I just knew a score that he needed to beat.
So let's hit the high points just to give people an idea of what that benchmark's against. So the critical pieces for that particular benchmark, the Firestrike benchmark, are the CPU and the GPU, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's mostly a GPU because it's a DirectX 11 benchmark.
So this guy was using, correct me if I'm wrong, a 6600K processor, which is a pretty rockin' i5.
Mm-hmm. Four cores, no hyper-threading.
And also a factory overclocked version of the 1070. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was the ASUS that he was running.
Oh, yeah. See, you talked to him more than I did. I was concentrating on trying to beat him.
So he was bringing a super clocked 1070 and a 6600K. And remind us again what you were running.
I was running a 7740X and the 780 Ti Kimkin edition.
All right.
Video card is already two generations old.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm running basically 6 gigahertz on a 4-core processor with hyperthreading. So I had the advantage with the hyperthreading, the extra, you know, clock speed. However, with Firestrike, it's mostly a GPU benchmark. So a lot of the scores, a lot of the changes in the score will be based off of how fast the GPU runs.
Right.
But that is also it's kind of like base clock, right? You change the base clock, everything goes faster. If you change the CPU speed, everything goes faster. So if you run a faster CPU, your video card will be faster in certain benchmarks, even though the video card is what drives it all, right? So with that 1200 score, I said, oh, I can beat that. Ran stock GPU and 6 gigahertz on the CPU, and I got, what was it? It was 11.9.
Close, I know.
Close, very close. And then he said, hey, I win. And it's like, no, that was just the baseline. Now it's time to start tweaking. So I start tweaking and I get to, 12.0. And then I added 10 megahertz to the video card and got 12.4. And basically I won.
And I wouldn't say that that was a superlative effort per se, because we had a lot of opportunity with the GPU. Still had some legs on it. The memory, which we didn't even touch.
No, it was just XMP. Well, it wasn't even XMP because it wouldn't run that fast on that CPU.
Nope. And we could have run quad channel memory if we needed to also. I mean, there's that.
Well, that would have to change processors, but
yeah.
Still an option.
But there were opportunities there. But mostly what I think was impressive is it gave us the opportunity to show that a good overclocked system still can compete with more modern hardware.
That brings up a good point, because after I posted my score, I brought them over and we looked at the screenshot that he'd taken a picture of, and we could compare how I was able to beat him. With the Firestrike benchmarks, you have the CPU test and you have the two GPU tests, and then you have the combined test. So we were looking at his GPU was much faster than mine, obviously, with the 1070, but my CPU was a lot faster and was able to make up that difference. And these are some of the key things that when you're submitting scores to HardwareBot, for instance, you can look at a score that you're trying to beat and look at the screenshot to see, okay, do I need more CPU or do I need more GPU? And that's one of those, you do a bit of research and you figure out how to get there so that you can beat those scores.
Well, one of the things I found really interesting was how much he thought the heavy lifting from his 1070 superclock was going to do. And of course, the infamous turbo button.
All right.
And so that was really his only experience with overclocking his system. And that's not uncommon. But I think maybe we should talk just a little bit about the difference between, you know, that high-end LN2 or even really just, you know, extreme overclocking in general versus these factory overclocking methods and really what the advantages and disadvantages are.
Oh, so like the easy one is the hot clock video card. So you can buy overclocking, right?
Sure.
You can go get a For the Win from EVGA. It's going to be faster than the stock one.
Yeah, I got a gaming edition for that very reason.
The turbo button, that is one where you can enable a setting in a motherboard BIOS and it will go and add 3 or 4 megahertz to your CPU.
Now, is this the same as the profiles on the Apex that you were talking about, or is that a little bit different?
No, it's going to be the same, really. The Apex has some overclocking profiles that are set by famous overclockers that have tested the board. Some of them, like, for instance, on the Apex, they have the SLAMS profile. And what that does is it sets the motherboard up for LN2 overclocking.
Okay, so that is different from the turbo button, because the turbo button is using basically what Intel thinks is the most dependable maximum clock based on your processor.
Right, yeah, that's turbo boost, basically, that all of them do turbo now, which is crazy, including NVIDIA with their Boost 3.0, where you might have 1200 megahertz as your default clock, and that's what NVIDIA sells. But then with Boost 3.0 kicks in, it goes almost to 2000 megahertz, and you get this amazing clock difference between stock and what it normally runs at. And people think that, oh yeah, I'm getting this amazing overclock by adding 30 megahertz to it, because they're looking at the base clock, not the boost clock where it normally runs.
That doesn't sound all bad, but I know that's not quite in the same thing, because it's not really a true overclocking, especially some of those where you're throttling the processor up and down really not consistently.
No, and that's where power efficiency factors into the mix. NVIDIA has done the Boost 3.0 so that they can get the maximum performance and power efficiency by ramping the clock up and then the clock back down. And it does it very, very fast. To get the most out of an actual real overclocking adventure, you have to enable the turbo boost all the time, which draws a lot more power, creates a lot more heat, but you get the best scores that way.
Well, Dennis, it wouldn't be a extreme overclocking attempt if we didn't talk about the results.
The results.
The results. And did you get any records, any cups, anything that was worth talking about from your overclocking experience?
Well, I was able to beat a 1070.
That's true, and that was impressive, and I think it made a pretty big impact in the crew that were around.
Yeah, it did. In terms of scores for HardwareBot, I was not able to really solidify anything. To be competitive with that particular processor, you have to run pretty close to 7 gigahertz. You have to have a strong memory controller so you can run the fast memory speeds. Fortunately, I was not able to get there, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it was still fun. We got the people at Boise Land to come over and check out our system. We were able to be an effective sideshow and a bit of a distraction. And I want to thank Constantine and the Boise Land folks for allowing us to do that. For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2018. Thanks for listening. Have you seen Mallrats?
I have seen Mallrats. Although it's been a while.
Did you think of it? Did you like it?
You know, I kind of felt like it was, I don't know, milking it maybe a little bit.
Milking.
Yeah, like we'd set up these great characters in Clerks and we'd explored them a little further. And then we got to Mallrats and it was kind of like, well, we need to do a Jay and Silent Bob movie, but we don't really know how. So we're just going to expand them and then build this kind of lesser story around them.
I can definitely see that But then Jay and Silent Bob strike back and kind of ties everything together.
Yeah, it does. And that was more of the same, but I don't think that you could have made that movie without the success of Mallrats and Chasing Amy because, yeah.